Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, April 26, 2022. Vice President Kamala Harris testing positive for COVID-19. The White House says she has no symptoms and will be isolating under the CDC protocols, and that she is not considered a close contact to President Joe Biden or First Lady Jill Biden. Supreme Court hearing a case on the Biden administration's attempt to end the Trump administration policy known as Remain in Mexico, requiring migrants seeking asylum who are not detained to go back to Mexico while their cases move through the system. We'll play some of the back and forth with the justices and the attorneys and also talk about the case with a USA Today Supreme Court correspondent. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin leading a conference in Germany on military support for Ukraine in its war to fend off the invasion from Russia, and is questioned about his earlier comments of wanting to see Russia weakened by this conflict. And Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Washington telling a Senate committee that U.S. diplomats will be returning to Ukraine's capital city, Kyiv. Plus, Attorney General Merrick Garland asked today by senators about fighting violent crime and the Hunter Biden investigation. A statement from Kirsten Allen, press secretary to Vice President Kamala Harris, reads, "Today, Vice President Harris tested positive for COVID-19 on rapid and PCR tests. She has exhibited no symptoms, will isolate, and continue to work from the vice president's residence. She has not been a close contact to the president or first lady due to their respective recent travel schedules. She will follow CDC guidelines and the advice of her physicians. The vice president will return to the White House when she tests negative." And then later, there was this statement from the White House. The president and the vice president spoke on the phone this afternoon. He wanted to check in and make sure she has everything she needs as she quarantines at home. As it turns out, Dr. Ashish Jha, the new White House COVID-19 response coordinator, was previously scheduled to appear for the first time during the regular White House briefing. And he was asked about the vice president's testing positive.
Every time a high-profile person like the vice president catches COVID for attention on the infection, for Americans following that news, what lessons should they draw from that experience that somebody as protected as her has caught COVID?
Good question. So I think if you take a step back and look at the vice president, she is boosted, actually twice boosted, right? We have a very, very contagious variant out there. It is going to be hard to ensure that no one gets COVID in America. That's not even a policy goal. The goal of our policies should be, obviously, minimize infections whenever possible, but to make sure people don't get seriously ill. The best ways of doing that are making sure people are vaccinated and boosted, as the vice president is, and making sure we have plenty of therapeutics, so that that is available as well. And that, to me, is the key lesson here.
And is she receiving any therapeutics, since we're on the topic of therapeutics?
You know, that's a conversation that she's having with her physician. I'm not her physician. I'm not privy to those conversations, so I don't know the answer to that.
Thank you, Dr. Jha. Welcome to the briefing, by the way. To your point that so many Americans can and will get this report that just came out today, that 60% of Americans have had COVID, the president is getting ready to ramp up his travel schedule. The vice president just caught it. She's twice boosted. Should Americans be prepared for a time when President Biden gets this? Is it just a matter of time that the president could get COVID?
I wouldn't say it's just a matter of time, but of course it is possible that the president, like any other American, could get COVID. The bottom line is he is vaccinated and boosted. He is very well protected. He's got very good protocols around him to protect him from getting infected. But there is no 100% anything. And I think the key focus has got to be, we got to continue protecting the president. That's what the protocols around him are designed to do. Let me leave it at that.
Dr. Ashish Jha, White House COVID-19 response coordinator, with reporters in the White House briefing room. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reporting today, or new data showing today, that 58% of the U.S. population, 75% of the young, have natural COVID antibodies from being exposed to the fast-spreading variants of coronavirus. And Vice President Kamala Harris tweeting, "Today I tested positive for COVID-19. I have no symptoms. I will continue to isolate and follow CDC guidelines. I'm grateful to be both vaccinated and boosted." Associated Press reports that the vice president received her first dose of the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine weeks before taking office, and a second dose just days after Inauguration Day in 2021. She received a booster shot in late October and an additional booster on April 1st. Now to the Supreme Court oral argument today in the case Biden v. Texas. It concerns President Biden's attempt to get rid of a policy on immigration from President Trump's administration that requires migrants who are seeking asylum to wait in Mexico as their cases are dealt with. It's called the Remain in Mexico policy, unofficially. We spoke with a USA Today Supreme Court correspondent, John Fritzy, about the case, what the justices are being asked to decide, and from listening to the oral arguments, if he thought there was a sense about how they might rule.
This is the second time that the Trump-era immigration policy, colloquially known as Remain in Mexico, also known as Migrant Protection Protocol, was before the Supreme Court. This is a policy that basically requires migrants, and it's usually asylum seekers who are seeking asylum, if they can't be detained, to be put back in Mexico where they await the review of their asylum application. This is a policy that the Trump administration proposed and implemented in 2019. And at its peak, there were about 70,000 people, migrants, enrolled in this program. You know, that created a lot of controversy. There are these images of tents along the border. There's a lot of question about the sort of the humanitarian implications of this policy. These reviews, by the way, can take months, if not years. So it's a long time for folks to wait on the border. The Trump administration's argument was, look, it's a deterrent, right? It keeps people from coming in the first place. And they're also concerned about, they were concerned about, as are Republicans today and conservatives on the court are concerned about this idea that people come into the country, they make an asylum claim, they're paroled into the country, basically allowed into the United States, never show up for their hearing and sort of disappear and are in the country illegally. This is what critics call sort of the catch and release policy, which you know gets a lot of people really fired up and angry. Flash forward to the Biden administration campaign promise that he would undo this program. They went ahead and tried to undo it in June. Texas and Missouri sued for the process the Biden administration used to undo it, said it didn't follow the rules. That went up to the Supreme Court late last year. Court said, hey, look, Biden administration, you gotta keep the policy in place. The Biden administration took a second attempt to unwind this policy, which they did in October. It's been litigated again, and now it's back up to the Supreme Court on a bunch of questions, but one of the questions is whether that second attempt satisfied the law for how administrations unwind such policies or not.
What did we learn from the justices' questions today about how they could potentially go in this case?
I think it's always easy for Supreme Court reporters to walk into the Supreme Court arguments and sort of have a lead in mind that it's a 6-3 court with conservatives. Immigration is a very partisan issue these days. So it's sort of easy to walk away with the idea that, well, the conservatives are going to be, you know, sort of with the quote unquote Republican or conservative position, and the liberals are going to be with the sort of quote unquote Democratic position. Of course, the court and justices strenuously reject that type of analysis. But I think in this case, it's true that it was very hard to sort of assess where everybody was. There were some really interesting questions from Chief Justice John Roberts for both the government and the Solicitor General for Texas, Judge Stone, about the implications, about how much they considered the potential benefit of sending people back to Mexico versus allowing them into the United States. You know, there were some really interesting questions from the conservatives. I would sort of say that the conservative justices were a little bit divided. You had, I think, Alito and Thomas probably in their questions indicating that they will be against the Biden administration. But the others that we watch in the courts, Roberts, Barrett, Kavanaugh, a little less clear where they're coming from. Their questions were pretty aggressive for both sides. Liberals, as we call them on the court, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Breyer, the three of them, I think, are pretty clearly have some support for the Biden administration's effort here. Kagan at one point had this really interesting argument she was making about, look, by requiring the Biden administration to implement this policy, basically tying the government's hands in regard to Mexico. So you can't just take Central Americans and put them back in Mexico without agreement from Mexico. And so the United States has to negotiate with Mexico for this MPP program at issue in the case. And Kagan is essentially arguing that the lower courts have put the Biden administration in this position of either violating a court order or having to let Mexico dictate the terms of the negotiation for when and how people are placed back in the country.
We're talking with John Fritzy, Supreme Court correspondent with USA Today. Read that there was some discussion about whether, in fact, a remain in Mexico policy is required under the law. But if it was new under if it was new under the Trump administration, how could that be?
Right. So this is a really interesting point. The Trump administration came up with this argument that the law basically required it, and that's based on a couple of things. So the law clearly requires the United States to detain people, to detain immigrants and migrants in this position. That's very clear. The law says you shall do it. The problem is that Congress has never given any administration the resources to do it. At court today, the Solicitor General, Elizabeth Perlager, noted that something like 220,000 encounters have taken place at the border in the month of March, and that the government had the funding from Congress for something like, I think it was 32,000 detention beds, right? So it just the government has just a fraction of the resources it needs to detain. Okay, so then the question is, well, what happens with these folks that you can't detain because you don't have the resources? What Texas and Missouri and the Trump administration argued is that you have to detain them. That you have to send them to Mexico, that the MPP program is based on this idea that the law requires the government to send these migrants to Mexico. Biden administration is looking at another part of the law that says, yeah, but we also have this authority for conditional parole. We have this authority to allow people to go into the United States and await their hearings. And that's sort of the part they're focusing on. Administration argues two points. One is that the law doesn't clearly say that there's no shall when it comes to returning them to Mexico. That's a may. So the government argues that they have discretion on whether to return people to Mexico or not. And the second thing they make is the point I think you're making, which is that, look, no administration's ever interpreted the law this way. Some of these laws have been around since the turn of the last century. So, no administration, Democratic or Republican, has ever interpreted a requirement that the United States return migrants to Mexico or Canada if they can't be detained.
John Fritzy, Supreme Court correspondent with USA Today. Find his story at usatoday.com and follow him on Twitter at JFritzy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
C-SPAN covered today's Supreme Court oral argument in that case, Biden v. Texas. Audio only, that's what the high court is feeding at the moment. And here's a couple of minutes of it, portions that the reporter mentioned. First, Chief Justice John Roberts questioning Elizabeth Prelogger, U.S. Solicitor General, about what happens if the court interprets the immigration law to require something that the executive branch says it cannot practically be done.
I am sympathetic with your position, which is that you can't detain enough people. You don't think you have to send people back through the return mechanism. And that's fine, I would say. One way to look at it is you're sort of taking away from yourself an option to comply with the statute. And then it gets to a question of the parole, interpretation of the parole provision, and whether or not I think significant public benefit can accommodate as far as you want to stretch it. So if I get to the point of looking at this and agreeing, basically saying there's nothing you can do given the statutory requirements, it's not — you're in a position where the facts have sort of overtaken the law. But in that situation, what are we supposed to do? It's still our job to say what the law is. And if we say what the law is and you tell us we can't do anything about it, where do you think that leaves us?
Well, I would say at the outset that to the extent that the court is inclined to say what the law is with respect to the detention and release authorities that you mentioned, 1225B2A, parole, I think that those should be challenged on their own terms if respondents disagree with how DHS is implementing those provisions. And instead, respondents said in the district court that they weren't even challenging our parole policies. Any judicial relief that could be necessary in that context should focus on those provisions.
The U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar questioned by the Chief Justice John Roberts. Arguing on behalf of Texas in this case, the Texas Solicitor General Judd Stone and Justice Elena Kagan asked him about whether Mexico would have too much influence over U.S. policy if the U.S. were required to send migrants seeking asylum to Mexico while their cases played out.
It doesn't really seem like a garden variety APA thing. To basically tell the executive how to implement its foreign and immigration policy. And that's what this does. It puts the United States essentially at the mercy of Mexico. Mexico knows that, you know, if we come out your way, well, Mexico has all the leverage in the world to say, well, you want to do that? You want to comply with the court's order? Here are 20 things that you need to do for us. Or maybe Mexico says, no, we'd like to see you squirm and not be able to comply with the court's order. And so we won't allow you to do the program regardless. And either way, I mean, it puts Mexico in a position vis-a-vis the United States, which I don't think it's really Texas's position to require.
A couple of points, Your Honor. The first is whether or not this required, in order to be implemented initially, Mexico's consent was a question of fact litigated on the merits in the district court. The district court made a finding of fact, which I don't understand petitioners to be challenging for clear error, that the United States was able to initially implement MPP without
Mexico's
consent.
Mexico can change its mind any day.
Well, certainly, Your Honor. And to the extent that petitioners were to show, well, Mexico has changed its mind and thus
or Mexico can change the conditions that it imposes for consenting any day. And the point is that requiring the secretary to do something like this essentially says to Mexico, it's all yours. You have control.
Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan questioning Texas's Solicitor General Judd Stone. You can find the full oral argument in the case Biden v. Texas, archived at cspan.org. It runs almost 2 hours. A federal judge in Louisiana Monday night temporarily blocked the Biden administration from ending another Donald Trump-era immigration policy known as Title 42. It allows border authorities to send migrants back to Mexico or their home countries, and it's based on a COVID-19 pandemic emergency. President Biden plans to end it based on a CDC recommendation. He said it would be on May 23rd. CNN writes that more than 20 states had asked the court to block the administration from ending Title 42 and last week asked the court to immediately intervene. Today, Senate leaders asked whether this issue will come up when the Senate considers emergency funding for COVID-19 programs from the Biden administration. First, here is the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York.
There's been a lot of concern from some of your moderate members and those up for re-election about Title 42 and the administration's decision to overturn that at the end of May. Do you think that decision should be delayed?
Look, the bottom line is, let me say this about Title 42. Number one, no, it shouldn't be used to hold up important things like COVID aid, number one. And number two, we're going to be working through this to see if we can come to a position that our caucus can agree on. There's divisions there now.
Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader with reporters. The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, also speaking with reporters, separate news conference. He says his party will insist on a vote related to Title 42.
With regard to Title 42, I think I'm safe to say Senate Republicans are going to insist on having an amendment to Title 42. This is extremely important. The border is already entirely too open. Pulling back the Title 42 authorities will only make it dramatically worse. And so I want to make it clear to you and to the majority leader that we'll need to have a Title 42 vote at some point here, in all likelihood, on the COVID package.
The Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, during his news conference with reporters. This is Washington Today. Now to Russia's war in Ukraine. This from Reuters, Dateline Ramstein Air Base in Germany. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin kicked off defense talks with more than 40 countries on Tuesday by expressing confidence that Ukraine can prevail against Russia in the two-month-old conflict. He said Ukraine clearly believes that it can win, and so does everyone here.
You know, the Battle of Iwo Jima took 36 days. The Battle of the Bulge lasted 40 days. And Ukraine has now beaten back the Russian military for 62 days. And so your resistance has brought inspiration to the free world, and even greater resolve to NATO, and glory to Ukraine. And we provided our assistance at record speed. And the whole world can see the difference that's making on the battlefield. You know, Putin never imagined that the world would rally behind Ukraine so swiftly and surely. And after Ukraine's defeat at the Battle of Kyiv, after Russia's defeat at the Battle of Kyiv, big distinction there, Mr. Minister, the war is now entering a new phase. But nobody is fooled by Putin's pretext or by his phony claims on the Donbas. So let's be clear. Russia's invasion is indefensible. And so are Russian atrocities.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin at the start of the Ukraine Security Conference at the U.S. Air Base in Germany. After, he held a news conference taking reporters' questions about the progress of the war and U.S. and Ukraine goals when it comes to Russia.
Next question goes to John Ismay, New York Times.
Mr. Secretary, yesterday you mentioned that one of the United States' goals in Ukraine now was to see Russia weakened. Can you explain more fully what that means, and specifically, what do you want to weaken, and how you would measure success in that regard?
Yeah, John, so I think we've been pretty clear from the outset. We do want to make it harder for Russia to threaten its neighbors and leave them less able to do that. Now, if you look at what's transpired here in this 62 days or so that that Ukraine and Russia have been involved in this struggle here, Russia has, in terms of its land forces, their land forces have been attrited in a very significant way. Casualties are pretty substantial. They've lost a lot of equipment. They've used a lot of precision-guided munitions. They've lost a major surface combatant. And so they are, in fact, in terms of military capability, weaker than when it started. And you know, John, it'll be harder for them to replace some of this capability as they go forward because of the sanctions and the trade restrictions that have been placed on them. And so we would like to make sure, again, that they don't have the same type of capability to bully their neighbors that we saw at the outset of this conflict.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, a news conference at Ramstein Air Base in Germany. The chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, speaking to CNN, saying it was completely irresponsible for the Russian foreign minister Sergei Lavrov to suggest that a nuclear war is possible over Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the tensions that have arisen. Back in Washington, D.C., Secretary of State Antony Blinken testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, confirming, as Bloomberg News writes, American diplomats will return to Ukraine as early as next week, starting with day trips into the western city of Lviv and eventually resuming a presence in Kyiv, according to a senior State Department official. That was Bloomberg. Here's what happened at today's hearing with the questions from Senator Ben Cardin, Democrat from Maryland.
Senator Hagerty and I have sent you a letter in regards to the subcommittee on the management of the State Department in regards to returning our mission to Kyiv. You've indicated that we are trying to comply with all the requests that are being made by President Zelensky. One is certainly to have our mission locate again in Kyiv. It is critically important. We have a new ambassador that has been named. We would like that her to be stationed in Kyiv. Mm-hmm. We recognize that you are doing some work in Lviv, but Kyiv is the capital. Can you just tell us your plans on returning our mission to Kyiv and whether you will comply with the request we made that we have a briefing as to the steps necessary to make sure that our mission is safe in Kyiv.
Yes. First of all, when it comes to a briefing, yes, we'll certainly do that. I appreciated your letter, the letter from you and Senator Hagerty. Two things. We are sending diplomats back to Ukraine this week, and they will begin to assess how we can most effectively and securely reopen the embassy in Kyiv. And I, without going into too much detail in this setting, I anticipate that we will be in Lviv and then head to Kyiv, subject to the president's final decision on that. But we are moving forward on that. We want to have our embassy reopened, and we're working to do that.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken questioned by Senator Ben Cardin. Another Reuters story. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres telling Russia's foreign minister on Tuesday that he was ready to fully mobilize the organization's resources to save lives and evacuate people from the besieged Ukrainian city of Mariupol. Secretary General Antonio Guterres in Russia to also meet with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. He'll then be traveling to Kyiv in Ukraine to meet with that country's President Volodymyr Zelensky. Zelensky, though, criticizing the order of the meetings, saying the war is in Ukraine. There are no bodies in the streets of Moscow. It would be logical to go first to Ukraine to see the people there, the consequences of the occupation. Back to Washington and that Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing with Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, saying that while Russia had no justification to invade Ukraine, the U.S. should not have pursued a policy that was guaranteed to make Russia upset. NATO membership for Ukraine.
Knowing full well that Ukraine was unlikely to ever join NATO since it had already been 14 years since they were said they were going to become members, why was it so important last fall, before this invasion, to continue agitating for Ukraine's admission to NATO?
Thank you, Senator. Not a question of agitating for Ukraine's admission. It's a question of standing up for the basic principle that we strongly adhere to, that there should be and will be an open-door policy when it comes to NATO membership. These are sovereign decisions for European countries to make and, of course, a decision for the NATO alliance to make in terms of making sure that a country that wishes to join actually adds value to NATO. But this goes to the heart of the international system and the international order. And part of that is a basic principle that one country can't dictate to another the choices it makes about with whom it allies, its foreign policies, its decision or not to try to engage with the European Union, with NATO. The other thing
and
I'd
yet,
say
yet, as we speak and we see the destruction in Ukraine, we also hear pronouncements from President Zelensky saying, well, you know what, maybe we might consider neutrality as a possibility. There could have been voices before this invasion, instead of agitating for something that we knew our adversary absolutely hated and said was a red line as recently as last September, before you signed the agreement, once again agitating for NATO, Russia said that it was a red line. Now, there is no justification for the invasion. I'm not saying that. But there are reasons for the invasion, and I think it's added nothing. In fact, had Ukraine been in NATO, as you've advocated for and many others have advocated for, we would now have troops in Ukraine. We may still have the destruction, but we would also have troops in Ukraine. If you were to put them in now, if it's still your policy that you want them in now, that means American troops go. The one good thing about them not being in is the most bellicose of our members here are not advocating for U.S. troops right now. That's a good thing. We have not had advocacy for U.S. troops because they're not part of NATO. Had they been or are they to become part of NATO, that means U.S. soldiers will be fighting in Ukraine, and that's something I very much oppose.
Senator, can I just say to that, because these are important conversations and arguments. My judgment is different. If you look at the countries that Russia has attacked over the last years, Georgia, leaving forces in Transnistria and Moldova, and then repeatedly Ukraine, these were countries that were not part of NATO. It has not attacked NATO countries for probably a very good reason.
You could also argue the countries they've attacked were part of Russia.
Well, that...
We're part of the Soviet Union.
Yes, and I firmly disagree with that proposition. It is the fundamental right of these countries to decide their own future and their own destiny. And
I'm not saying it's not, but important. I'm saying that the countries that have been attacked, Georgia and Ukraine, were part of the Soviet Union.
And that does not give
Russia
any right to attack
them. And they were part of the Soviet Union since the 1920s.
But that does not... That does not give Russia the right to attack them. On the contrary,
no one's saying it does, but it really has nothing to do with being part of this
empire by force.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken questioned by Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, during today's Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing. Find the full hearing archived at cspan.org. The Hill newspaper, writing about the exchange you just heard, puts it this way. Historically, Senator Paul has been against the expansion of NATO. In 2017, Paul blocked a vote on a treaty for Montenegro to join NATO, causing the late Senator John McCain, Republican from Arizona, to accuse him of working for Vladimir Putin, referring to the Russian president, as Russia also opposed the move. One area in which the U.S., Canada, European Union, and Japan continue to cooperate with Russia despite the rift over the war in Ukraine is the International Space Station. But the head of the Russian Space Agency recently threatened to end that cooperation because of sanctions imposed by the Western nations. Today, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson asked about the future of the ISS.
And we have someone on the phone. We have Jeff Faust from Space News. Jeff.
Good morning. Question for the administrator. I know you've emphasized that space station operations have remained normal in recent months despite the geopolitical situation on the ground. But I'm curious, looking to the long term, given the continued bombastic statements by your counterpart, Dmitry Rogozin, do you have any confidence that Russia will remain part of the space station beyond 2024 and agree to an extension of the station to 2030? And what planning are you making in case Russia decides not to extend on the ISS? Thanks.
Jeff, specifically, I have the confidence because look at the history. In the middle of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, 1975, an American spacecraft and a Soviet spacecraft rendezvoused and docked, and those crews became fast friends forever, so much so when General Alexei Leonov, the commander of the Soviet vehicle, just passed away a couple of years ago. Who gave the eulogy in Moscow? General Tom Stafford, the American commander. And I see that right now. I see the professional relationship between the Russians on board, the cosmonauts, and the astronauts. I see the friendliness between the two crews. I see that in the mission control in Moscow and also in Houston. I see that on the exchange of crews that we plan to continue of flying Russian cosmonauts on the space shuttle and American astronauts on the Soyuz. Mark Vandehei just returned after a year in space. He came back with his crew. Who was his crew? The Soyuz. And they just landed in Kazakhstan. And so despite the horrors that we are seeing with our eyes daily on television of what's happening in Ukraine as a result of political decisions that are being made by the president of Russia, despite all of that, despite a war going on in Ukraine, I see that professional relationship with astronauts and cosmonauts and the ground teams in the two respective mission controls. I see that continuing.
NASA Administrator Bill Nelson at Kennedy Space Center in Florida, ahead of the SpaceX Crew 4 mission to send astronauts to the International Space Station, a pre-launch news conference. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. Attorney General Merrick Garland testifying today before Senate Appropriations Subcommittee about his department's budget request for the next fiscal year. And one of the issues that came up, fighting crime. The FBI Director Christopher Wray said in an interview on CBS's 60 Minutes program this past weekend that violent crime rates are rising around the country, including more committed by juveniles and more gun trafficking. And he said, we're seeing an alarming frequency of some of the worst getting back on the streets. Here's part of today's hearing on Capitol Hill with the Attorney General Merrick Garland. Questions from Senator John Kennedy, Republican from Louisiana.
Let's take Chicago, where we haven't made any inroads in stopping the killing. I mean, Chicago is now the world's largest outdoor shooting range. We know that a lot of the shootings come from gangs. Why wouldn't you want to call the police chief and the mayor in Chicago and say, look, you know who these gang members are. When you have reasonable suspicion under Terry v. Ohio, an objective standard, more than just a hunch, why don't you aggressively stop, question, and frisk these gang members? You'll get guns off the street, you'll get drugs off the street, and you'll get a lot of gang members off the street, and you'll stop people killing each other. Why won't you do that?
Look, the best way for the federal government to stop violent crime is to work at each local level and determine and let the state and locals determine what the best use of their own
Judge,
resources
I'm sorry for interrupting
is.
You, but I'm trying to get some answers.
I'm sorry.
Why won't you do that? Just tell me why you won't do
because,
that. Your
because,
opinion matters.
Because there is no one solution fits all that the federal government can suggest to state and local law enforcement. We believe state and local law enforcement knows best as to what to do there. We provide
well, it's not working.
We provide our technical expertise. We put lots of resources into joint task forces. We
well,
pick
General,
up.
Is that, I know I've got to shut this down. I've only got 15 seconds. Is that why you're asking in the middle of a raging inflation for 7% more money, $2.63 billion to provide technical increase or technical advice? I mean, we're going backwards here on crime, General. You're the state's or the country's chief law enforcement officer. And you won't even answer my question about how you feel about stop, question, frisk. Why should
we give
you more
money? I think it's a resource allocation issue for each local police department. I believe that the Justice Department does the best by putting the money that we're asking for is increase in law enforcement that can be assisting the state and locals.
But, General,
in the best
is that what
way.
We're supposed to tell the mothers of those kids getting killed in Chicago? You don't understand. It's a resource allocation issue.
No, what you're supposed to tell the mothers in Chicago and what I told them when I was there was the Justice Department was there to provide all the resources that this subcommittee will give us to stop violent crime.
But yet
the
you
more
won't,
resources
won't
you
try
can give us.
Stop question and frisk.
That is a question for the state and the local, I'm sorry, for the state and the local law enforcement.
Attorney General Merrick Garland getting questioned by Senator John Kennedy, Republican from Louisiana. A Gallup poll published this month finds 53% of Americans worry a great deal about crime. First time a majority has said that in the poll since 2016. Another 27% polled worry about crime a fair amount. Another issue that came up during today's hearing with the Attorney General, brought up by Republican senators, the investigation of Hunter Biden, son of President Joe Biden. The New York Post writes, the first son is under investigation for possible tax fraud, money laundering, and foreign lobbying crimes and documents, and indicate that Joe Biden was linked to many of the enterprises under review. Here's Senator Bill Hagerty, Republican from Tennessee, with the questions.
Would you think it would be appropriate for the President of the United States to call you into the Oval Office and tell you that his son didn't break the law regarding this matter?
Absolutely not. And the president has not done that. And the president has committed not to interfere not only in that investigation, but any other kind of
well, I agree with you, but
investigation.
But I do wonder this then, why the president is resorting to TV and having his surrogates go on TV to say just that message. Earlier this month, White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain stated on national television that, quote, the president is confident that his son didn't break the law. And the White House communications director said that President Biden maintains his position that his son did nothing that was unethical. This is on national television. The president's already told his subordinates, clearly, that these are people that he can fire at will, that he and his family did nothing wrong. How can the American people be confident that his administration is conducting a serious investigation?
Because we put the investigation in the hands of a Trump appointee from the previous administration, who's the United States Attorney for the District of Delaware, And because you have me as the Attorney General who is committed to the independence of the Justice Department from any influence from the White House in criminal matters.
Well, I think the observation here is terribly critical because there's an obvious conflict of interest here because of those who are investigating the Biden family and their enterprise can be fired by the head of the family who's being investigated. That is, Joe Biden can fire the Attorney General in Delaware. He can have an impact on all of your staffing. And I want to ask you this. Under what circumstances do you consider or how do you evaluate whether you would appoint a special counsel?
Well, I think this is a fact and law question in each case, determining and depending upon how cases go forward and a question of whether the Justice Department, with its normal processes, should continue. I want to be clear, though, special counsels are also employees of the Justice Department. Yeah. We don't have an independent counsel statute anymore. Both the Democrats and the Republicans experimented with this, and I think probably in the end neither side liked it, and that's why we ended up with the law not being reauthorized. But in any event, the special counsel is also an employee of the Justice Department.
Have you had any consideration about whether to do this? Or
again, I think our internal deliberations have to stay within the department.
Got it. Again, I'll just restate that there's an obvious conflict there that raises concerns amongst my constituents. I'd like to turn to some public evidence, though. There are emails and photographs that show that President Biden, while he was vice president, met several of Hunter Biden's business associates, including a Burisma executive, that's the energy company that paid Hunter Biden $1 million per year to sit on its board, and a Russian billionaire who paid Hunter's firm $3.5 million around the same time. All of this is while President Biden was running portions of the United States foreign policy, including Ukraine. There's evidence that Hunter Biden paid for Joe Biden's living expenses while he was vice president. A Hunter Biden email from 2010 entitled Joe R. Biden Bills, discusses paying for the upkeep of Joe Biden's large lakefront home. There's another 2010 email from a Biden confidant to Hunter Biden saying, quote, "Your dad just called me. He could use some positive news about his future earnings potential." To me, this suggests that Joe Biden's $231,000 salary is taxpayer-funded salary, and lifestyle as vice president of the United States weren't enough to support his lifestyle. That same confidant of and also Hunter Biden's business partner made 9 visits to the White House between 2009 and 2013 and met with Joe Biden in the West Wing while Joe Biden was vice president. And we have a text message from Hunter Biden to his daughter stating that, "Don't worry, unlike Pop," meaning Joe Biden, "I won't make you give me half your salary." So it seems President Biden was serving as vice president and running U.S. foreign policy at the same time that his son Hunter Biden was raking in money from shady foreign business deals, and this was money that was being diverted to benefit Vice President Biden. So, General Garland, do you have any reason to dispute the evidence that indicates that President Biden was involved with and using money from Hunter Biden's business deals?
Senator, following the long-standing rule of the Justice Department, we don't discuss investigations or evidence that may or may not be relevant to investigations. That's a matter for the United States Attorney's Office that's investigating the case.
Well, there's great. Thank you.
Senator Bill Hagerty, Republican from Tennessee, and the Attorney General Merrick Garland, a hearing of the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee that oversees the Justice Department budget. On Wall Street today, the Dow down 809, NASDAQ down 514, S&P down 120. From roll call on Capitol Hill, the Senate voted 52-43 Tuesday to confirm Lael Brainard, a member of the Federal Reserve Board, to become vice chair, but fell short of the vote needed to move forward with Lisa Cook's nomination to join the board. Democrats didn't have the votes needed to invoke cloture and limit debate on Cook's nomination after Senators Ron Wyden of Oregon, Christopher Murphy of Connecticut tested positive for COVID-19. And with Vice President Kamala Harris also out because of COVID-19, Democrats wouldn't have been able to even break a tie. The 47-51 vote, latest obstacle for Cook, who would be the first black woman to join the Fed board. By the way, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer did change his vote from yes to no procedural. That allows him to call up another vote at a later time. From CNBC, Tesla stock closed down more than 12% on Tuesday as the tech-heavy NASDAQ composite slipped nearly 4%. Declines come just a day after Twitter's board approved Elon Musk's $44 billion acquisition of the company, showing some of the fall off may be a reflection of investor concerns with the deal. Musk has secured $25.5 billion of fully committed debt, including $12.5 billion in loans against his Tesla stock. On Capitol Hill, the Senate leaders asked about the implications of Elon Musk, the world's richest man, buying the social media company Twitter. First, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky.
Elon Musk, it was announced yesterday, purchased Twitter. Some of your colleagues on the other side of the aisle have already come out and said that that's a danger to democracy. Antitrust laws need to be put in place to stop sales like this. Your reaction that Elon Musk has purchased Twitter?
An incredible event. It'll be interesting to see what impact it has on the way Twitter operates. But we're all watching it with a great deal of interest because there's certainly been our share of complaints about the way it's been run in the past.
The Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader Democrat Chuck Schumer, also asked about this.
Do you have any reaction to Elon Musk buying Twitter? And Amy Klobuchar just briefed your caucus on antitrust, big tech antitrust legislation. Are you going to bring that to the floor?
Okay. On the second question, we had a very good discussion. She made a very powerful presentation, and I'm working with her to see that we can get 60 votes to get to the floor. On Elon Musk, I would say, look, in many ways, Twitter has been a dark, dark place. I hope it doesn't get any darker.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer with reporters. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau put out a report this week about people's medical debt. It finds a total debt in the U.S. is $88 billion, that 58% of bills that are in collections and appear on credit reports are medical-related, and that's 43 million credit reports showing such collections. And complaints are up 31% in the last 3 years about debt collectors trying to get consumers to pay amounts already paid or simply not owed. The director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Rohit Chopra, testifying today before the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee, and the chair, Democrat Sherrod Brown of Ohio, questioning him about this issue.
Protecting Americans from medical debt is a priority for this administration. Just this year, CFPB released several reports on medical debt highlighting inaccuracies on credit reports and wrongful attempts by debt collectors to go after people for medical debt that they don't actually owe. What's CFPB planning to do to address both the misconduct and the mistakes related to medical debt?
Well, I appreciate that. Today in the United States, the most common collection item on an American's credit report is actually medical debt. And many of us are concerned, based on the data we see, the research we see, and the complaints we see, that much of this is not even really owed. Many Americans are caught in a doom loop between their insurance company and their medical provider, and they're coerced to pay once it's put on that credit report. We need to make sure that that debt is accurate, and we are looking to determine whether the law should be changed or adjusted accordingly when it comes to medical billing. And with respect to the CFPB's authorities, we are looking at whether medical debt should be included at all, absent further requirements or changes.
The CFPB Director Rohit Chopra, questioned by Senator Sherrod Brown, Chair of the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. We covered this hearing as well. You can find the full video at cspan.org, and there was a lot of other issues covered. The Hill newspaper starts its article this way: Senate Republicans ripped the Biden administration's top financial watchdog Tuesday, as the agency takes aggressive steps to expand its oversight and regulation. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. You can get more top Washington stories sent right to you each day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. Sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.